Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A co-presentation of WNYC Studios and Night Vale Presents.
You are listening to the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
When we last left the janitor, of course he'd hypnotized everybody. Yes, everybody. What happened next? Well, it's not quite in the holiday spirit, at least not in the spirit of a holiday episode, which this is. So we're going to spare you that and rectify another injustice we recently subjected you to. You'll remember that last episode the janitor began playing a feature presentation in John Cameron's dressing room.
Look what I have in my bag. It's a feature presentation.
And we didn't let you hear it. Well, that's what we're going to do now. It didn't go very well for him.
What are you doing with the tape machine?
Why have you pulled the giant tape machine in this room?
But we hope it goes better for you. On the tape itself was a photograph dated December 22nd, 1930. It's a photograph taken amidst the glow of a classic department store holiday display. And without further ado, we give you our feature presentation, First Night.
I'm going to tell you about this kid. So you know those places on Park Avenue, those beautiful mansions like, you know, the Morgan Library or something like that. Well, this kid lived in one of those places. But he doesn't even know he's living in a mansion on Park Avenue. He's that sheltered. All he knows is his aunt and his servants. This kid sees New York through a succession of windows. His big Park Avenue mansion, or the windows of the limousine that takes him on the rare occasions that they let him out of the house. So this kid, Alistair, was like 6 years, I don't know, 8 years old. The parents died in a car accident. The aunt's got all these rules and regulations. It's not like the aunt's a bad person. She loved the kid. I mean, the kid was all she had. But you'd never know it by seeing the way she treated him. And of course, he'd never know it. Okay, so it's Christmas Eve, and she's going to bring out the box. Now, the box, once a year, it's like a ceremony. They open up the safe, they bring out the box. And to the kid, the box seems like it's magic. This is the one thing that his aunt is going to actually touch. She opens up the box. What's in the box? Beautiful glass things that are going to hang on the friggin' tree. And the thing about these ornaments are, I don't know, it's probably, you know, the father's or the father's father's. Obviously, it's been passed down through the family, and it means something to her. I mean, she don't even let the servants touch them. They do everything around the house, but not this, not on Christmas Eve. Okay, so now the ornaments are out, and they bring in a ladder. And the aunt gets on the ladder. I mean, this is the only work she does all year. She gets on the ladder and starts hanging these little glass ornaments. And God forbid you get near one of these things, she'll rip your head off. And with each glass ornament she puts up there, it's like she's melting. It's like this ice queen, little by little, is thawing out. And when she's finally got that last ornament up, she looks over her work. And she exhales and she says, "Now it's Christmas." And that's the one moment every year that the kid Alistair lives for. And there's one more thing. One year she actually let the kid out of the house and they drove to Herald Square. And I think it was, I don't think it was Macy's, I think it was Gimbel's. And they're shopping in Gimbel's and the kid looks up. And who's there? Santa Claus. And she actually let the kid get in the line and wait there with other kids his age. And after maybe 15, 20 minutes, finally was his turn. So little Alistair sits down on Santa's lap. And what does Santa say to the kid? You're a good boy. That's it. You're a good boy. Just you're a good boy. And the funny thing is that no one has ever told Alistair that he was a good boy. No one. So you can see why Christmas is everything to this kid. So they brought in this huge, huge Christmas tree every year. The favorite thing this kid can do is to climb under this massive tree and just be next to all the presents. Now, the kid's got to sneak and get under there because the aunt has been telling him a million times, don't go near the tree, don't go near the tree. But he's small, so he can get in there, and he does it every year. So this kid's under the tree now, and something's not right. He's feeling woozy, and he knows he's not supposed to be under the tree to begin with. So the kid gets up, loses his balance, and he knocks into the tree, and this is one of those big, rich people trees. And the thing comes falling down, and it just smashes every ornament on that thing. And he's standing there, and the ant is sputtering. She's making these wheezing sounds. She says, you ruined Christmas. And she sends him to bed. On Christmas Eve, no less. And he drifts off to sleep. But it's a fevered sleep, and the ant's not heartless. She goes and feels his head, and it's burning, and she feels horrible. The kid has got 103 degrees fever, and she's a rich person. What does she do? She calls in a medical team. The doctors and nurses say, yeah, the kid is really sick, and she's got a problem. So he's laying in bed, 103 degree fever. He's having these horrible dreams that maybe he did actually ruin Christmas. And he actually dreams that his aunt let him go and play with some kids. And he goes out and starts playing with the kids. And they all turn on him. They shun him because he's the kid that ruined Christmas. And he wakes up in a cold sweat. It's 5 a.m. in the morning. He wants his Christmas. He's still in kind of a feverish state. And he just walks into the living room. And instead of seeing the tree, he sees all this weird medical equipment, and there's no Christmas there. And he doesn't know what's going on. Goes downstairs, he opens up the door of the mansion, and he looks out, and there in the gutter is his Christmas tree and all the ornaments. And he goes out, which takes a lot of guts for this kid, and there's all these Christmas trees laying in the street like garbage. And he thinks it's all his fault. And now he's really going crazy, and he starts walking a couple of blocks away, and he goes past an all-night diner, and there's a guy outside, and he's taking down all the Christmas decorations and the wreaths and everything. And the kid goes up to him and says, what are you doing? It's Christmas. And the guy goes, Christmas is over, kid. Good riddance. And he looks at him, he says, where's your mother? Kid runs off. And now he starts wandering around the city. And this kid has never done that before. And he turns into an alley. And what does he see? A guy is laying there, passed out, filthy, cold, shivering, curled up in a fetal position. And the kid looks and he goes, it's Santa Claus.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We will return to our story in just a moment. Till then, take a break to enjoy your holiday cheer and listen to these words.
Welcome to episode 6 of this special edition of the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air, with commentary following each episode and a director's cut of the season finale.
And now we return you to our feature presentation, First Night.
Okay. The thing is, it's December 29th. The kid has been sick. He's been sedated for 4 days. But he thinks it's Christmas morning. And the kid thinks he's found Santa Claus passed out in an alley. And he thinks it's his fault. He put him there. But what he's really found is me. You know, most of the derelicts wound up on the Bowery. But hey, I love Times Square. So I wake up, and what do I find? There's a blanket on me. There's a hamburger from Needick's and an Orangeade. Now, I don't know what the hell's going on, but I ate half the hamburger, I pulled the blanket over me, and I went back to sleep. So I wake up again. What's there? Breakfast. What the hell is going on? And then I find a note. I can't hardly read it. It's like a crazy person wrote it. And it says, "The world needs you. We all need you." And this kid comes out, and he's talking to me. He's pleading with me, and I can't make out head or tail of what this guy's saying. This kid keeps on apologizing to me. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry." And suddenly it dawns on me. This kid thinks I'm Santa Claus. I mean, yeah, I got the white beard, but I'm a Jew. And I also realize that this kid has been running around stealing stuff from me. And I'm looking at him, and hey, to me, he doesn't look right. He's pale. He's sweating. The kid's sick. So I ask the kid where he lives. And he keeps apologizing. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But I got to get this kid home." And he keeps telling me to go home, to the North Pole. And he's getting flush, and I don't realize that he's, like, passing out. And I take him around a corner to the 18th precinct, and I lay him on his steps. I ring the bell, and I run. I mean, I just don't like police stations. So I go back to my cardboard box, and for some reason I can't stop thinking about this kid. And the next morning I look at the Daily Mirror, and there's a big headline: "Runaway Rich Kid Found." And there's his picture on the cover of the Daily Mirror. And there's a picture of where the kid lives. And it's that big mansion on Park Avenue. And it says in the story that the kid might not make it. And look, I know you can't believe all the shit you read in the paper. So I find myself walking over to Park Avenue. I go to the servant's entrance, of course. And I knock. So the head of the kitchen answers the door. She thinks I came for a handout. And I tell her my story, and now she thinks I'm here for a really big handout. So she goes to get the aunt, but meanwhile, I'm grilling the other servants to find out how the kid is. And they tell me that the kid is in some delirium, and he just keeps talking about Christmas, and no one understands. So I split. Now, I got a brother-in-law in Jersey City. He does demolition and stuff like that. So I get on a train and go out there. I go to his house. I get cleaned up a little bit. And I do a day's work. And I go to one of those, you know, costume shops they have there. And I say to the guy, "You got a Santa costume?" And what do you know? It's half price. So I change into the thing right there in the shop. I get on a bus. And everybody's looking at me like I'm just crazy. And I'm giving them all a finger. So I march right up to the house. I knock on the door of the servant's entrance. I demand to see the aunt. She looks distraught. And I tell her I need to see the kid, and I don't even wait for an answer. I go find where he is. So I go up to him, and I put on my best Santa voice. And I tell him I'm going to go straight to the North Pole, and I'm going to bring Christmas back. And I tell the kid everything he wants to hear. And the aunt is in the doorway the whole time, and she's watching this. She turns around, and she runs off. And she grabs every servant in the house. And all of a sudden, she's like Stalin. She's giving out orders to everybody. She's got the whole place in an uproar. And in 5 minutes, she's got them bringing in a tree. And she makes a Christmas for that kid like you would not believe. She makes a Christmas for that kid. I slip out the back door. The kid got better.
Broadcasting from the top of the Eiffel Tower, the Orbiting Human Circus of the Air.
This is not John Cameron. He's still frozen in a hypnotic trance. This is the janitor's narrator saying, while there's still a chance, the orbiting human surface wishes you a good night.
Hey, microphone. I'm outside of my closet. Anyway, I'm gonna lean you up against the closet door. The thing is, sometimes when the sauce think I'm not there or I'm asleep, they actually sing. Like, in my closet. I can just feel, like, when it's gonna happen. Like you know how some people can tell when it's gonna rain? Like, I can just feel it in my body. And, I think it's gonna happen now. So I'm not going in. I just thought you should hear it. Brr. I'm not too cold. I've got this jacket. Mr. Cameron gave it to me. Oh, listen, it's the sauce.
The Orbiting Human Circus of the Air is a co-presentation of WNYC Studios and Night Vale Presents. Welcome to this special commentary for Season 1 of The Orbiting Human Circus. If you are a new listener, we strongly recommend that you listen to the complete narrative season first, and then return to these commentaries.
I guess, like, one of the next big things that probably happened for me growing up was discovering concept albums. Because both my mom and dad were teenagers when Sgt. Pepper's came out. Actually, I have a memory of my dad actually playing, I think it was probably when the first CD reissue of Sgt. Pepper's came out. Like, my dad sat down, like, bought the CD, and we sat down. I was a little boy still. Like, we sat down in his apartment and like, put it on and just listened. And that was so cool because it was like, we were listening to the record like watching a movie or going to a concert. Like, we were experiencing the record. And I totally got, you know, partially because of the cassettes, the way that I was conditioned to listen to sound and think of recorded sound from my grandma already, like, I think I just really took it as an experience. Like, I got lost in it. Like, the idea that someone could make a record that, like, was for you to just totally disappear into, to take you on a trip or take you someplace, a journey, or that was so exciting. And kind of by the time that I was in my early teens, I ended up sort of in a much more isolated place physically. My mid-teens, my mom and stepfather had moved to Florida, and where we lived was also kind of far from everybody else, you know, like my school, and there weren't sidewalks, you know, on these roads really a lot, you know, big roads, so it was kind of hard to get places. And I had a best friend that really loved records, and I had gotten my first four-track cassette recorder, and I started making these little concept albums that were kind of stories and environments for him, mostly. And they, you know, they had songs, but the songs were kind of also would go in and out of sound, things made out of sounds. Like, I wanted to make amusement park rides or something, you know, make an amusement park ride someone could go on, or he could go on in this case then. And I would give them to him at school, and then I would know that he was in his room after school listening to them. And it made me feel really wonderful, and it made me want to make another one, you know, because then he'd tell me about listening to it. And so, in a sense, I was kind of doing what my grandma did for me, but now I was getting to do it through the form of, like, my ridiculous, you know, early teenage idea of what a concept album was. Also very influenced, I think, by before I'd moved to Florida, and when I was able to go back up to New York to see my dad, I would end up going down to PS122 a lot, which was this place where a lot of performance art stuff was happening, when performance art, I feel like, was really hitting. And there was one person named Penny Arcade who I loved, and she used to do all these characters, and you know, people were sort of inventing what performance art was, even on the fly, obviously, and it was just kind of this medium where you could kind of create whatever you wanted, and she was a big inspiration. So I think those cassettes I were making were sort of like influenced by her, you know, and the Beatles, and in some ways They Might Be Giants, who I saw as making concept albums and made up stories for their records, even though I don't know if they saw them that way. And they also used sound. That was another reason I loved them, was they used weird sounds that weren't normally in pop songs. You know, a typewriter or, you know, something like that would suddenly come in. And around that time, there was a community radio station in Florida where I lived, WMNF, and some of the DJs became aware of that I existed and what I was doing, and sort of somehow I got invited down to the station, and I would go there sometimes when I could, because it was just like another sort of cocoon of warmth, and, you know, it wasn't like people trying to beat you up or people throwing things at you out of cars when you're walking next to no sidewalks and, you know, whatever else, you know, and being insecure. One of those DJs in particular had this really great kind of experimental show, and he was just, I don't know if I asked him or what, but somehow there was this idea of me making a serial, and it would be like 5-minute segments on his show, and he would play them, and they let me use the production studio there, which had quarter-inch tape, reel-to-reel machines, and turntables, and there were sound effects records. And so I made up this story about Dr. Seuss had just died, and so I made up a story about him faking his death and to start an underground surrealist revolution to kind of bring out around a new surrealist reality. And so there were all these kids and people who were kind of like employees. They would get these orders, these very bizarre orders in the mail, and they would get paychecks, but they would never understand the big plan. And that was kind of what the show was about. I was very young, and so it was kind of horrible. but it was so much fun. And so in a way, that was almost like the first time I got to do something like this, the Orbiting Human Circus. So then years later, I was in Athens, and I had begun making records, which I was still making concept records, but now they're actually coming out on record labels. They're beginning to come out on record labels. And in a sense, I was, you know, I feel like I was just doing what I'd always done, which was try to tell a big story, try to create an environment. And I had a lot of really wonderful friends who were really special artists and young, just, you know, especially humans, and we all kind of ended up converging after a lot of time together in Athens, Georgia, where it cost nothing to live. There was nothing to do at that time, and you could literally, your rent was like $200 a month, if that, and you'd be splitting it with someone else. And then I was supposed to make a record of new songs for our record label, Merge Records, but I started to want to make this record that was just a big story, and I had it narrated by Brian Duan, who's a big part of the Orbiting Human Circus, who was one of my heroes and is one of my heroes. So he had narrated this crazy, big, long 70-minute album that was a story with sound effects and music and things, but no songs. There wasn't a single song on it. And I was supposed to be making a record of songs. And the thing was that I knew that this wouldn't fly. Like, there's nothing Merge could have done with it in place of the second record of songs that they were due. So I was making a record of songs at the same time. And so I just kind of kept making the record of songs, and I never told them about it. And I was also, at this point, I ended up back in New York City, and I had no money because New York was actually expensive, and I could barely pay my rent or anything. So like I took like a bunch of I handmade a bunch of versions of the Crazy Story record, which was the second Imaginary Symphony, and brought it down to a record store, and where my best friend from high school, the one that I was making the original cassettes for, was now working. And so he bought a bunch of them off of me. And then I went to this other record store that was Kim's Underground, if you live in New York and remember it. And then I went to Other Music and sold them a bunch. And anyway, one night, so I didn't know, like, I was taking forever to make this song record. I didn't even know if my song record had a place in the world. I knew that this other story thing had no place in the world. There weren't podcasts yet. And one day, like, a friend of mine called me up and said, "Julian, turn on the radio." And on WNYC, the New York's, you know, it's like an institution I grew up with. That's New York's NPR station. And it was playing. The whole thing was playing on the air, like on the radio, like 70 minutes of it from beginning to end in like prime time. And I just couldn't understand what was happening. But it was like this crazy magic thing. And I mean, I was so caught up in like the, you know, it's like I was picturing it, you know, like I said, vibrating through soup spoons and it was really on the radio. A DJ there at WNYC had gone into the record store, seen the little handmade copy, bought it, and decided to play it on the radio. And that was such a special thing. That was like such an affirmation. And it just made me feel like, wow, there, you know, there could be a place in the world for this stuff.
The Orbiting Human Circus is written, created, and co-directed by Julian Koster. It was co-directed by and developed with Ellie Heyman and produced by Christy Gressman, with musical composition and arrangement by Thomas Hughes and songs by The Music Tapes, and editing by Grant Stewart, sound design by Eric Slider, with recording engineer Vincent Cascione and associate producer Robbie Cucciaro. Episode 6 featured Julian Koster, Drew Callender, John Cameron Mitchell, Susanna Flood, and Larry Ratzo-Sloman. For full credits and to learn more about the Orbiting Human Circus, come visit us at orbitinghumancircus.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.